on rules will come to order. Let's see.
I'm sorry, Senator Beyer. We have a work session for the purpose of considering measure drafting and introduction requests. We have several measures scheduled for hearings and a couple more for work sessions, so we're going to be skipping around. And then we do have a presentation as well. So we've got a lot going on. Jim, can you tell us about our measure drafts?
Members, you have four measures for introduction. These are LCs. I have copies of the LCs if anyone wants to see them. I'll just list them here. LC 3501, LC 0510, LC 3482, and LC 3483. You've approved each of these for drafting previously.
Do I have a motion?
Senator, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would move that we accept for measure introduction requests the LC 3501, 3510, 3482, and 3483.
Senator Kleiner has moved that the bill introductions as presented by staff be approved. Is there any discussion to that motion? Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Thank you. Did I wake you up, Senator Burdick?
Senator Beyer.
I think you hit his finger.
So nice.
Finger.
What do we do? Just
okay. Next, I would like to open a hearing on SJR 13, SJR 14, SJR 30. Senator Clarno, do we have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move we refer SJR 13 to the Revenue Committee, SJR 14 to the Transportation and Economic Development Committee, SJR 30 to the Committee on Revenue.
Is there any discussion regarding that motion? Thank you, Senator Beyer. You're such a stickler for details.
Okay. Do you want me to do that again?
Please.
SJR 13, I would move, Madam Chair, that we refer SJR 13 to the Committee on Revenue and the SJR 14 to the Committee on Transportation and Economic Development and SJR 30 to the Committee on Revenue.
Seeing as we are in work session, is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, it is so moved.
How am I doing this? You want a motion on SM3?
Please.
Madam Chair, I move...
Let me open a work session on SM3 and SM1.
Madam Chair, I move that SM3 be referred to the Committee on Ag and Natural Resources and SM1 be referred to the Committee on Water and Land Use.
Thank you. Senator Clarno has moved SM3 to the Committee on Ag and Natural Resources and SM1 to the Committee on Water and Land Use. It is both of the committee chairs have agreed to this particular disposition with these two bills. Is there any discussion on this motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so moved. Thank you, Senator Clarno. Back to... Either one of you need to leave early. Are you guys okay on 137 and 140?
Fine early.
Oh, Jason.
Okay, all right. So I'm gonna 137.
Okay.
And then Jim, do 141 and 319 work sessions.
Work sessions, right.
Okay. I'm gonna open a work session on Senate Bill 137. Mr. Stembridge, what do we have in front of us?
Members, you heard this on the 6th of February. This removes a statutory prohibition on portraits submitted for inclusion in the voter's pamphlet. And it does a number of other things. Prohibits the Secretary of State from printing the title of a cited person or the name of a cited organization in arguments opposing or supporting any measure in the voter's pamphlet without citing the public source and date of the citation. It increases the limitation on the age of a candidate's voter's pamphlet portrait from 2 years to 4 years, and it extends the state voter's pamphlet regulations to county voter's pamphlets. You have the dash 3 amendments. The dash 3 amendments restores current language on candidate portraits, leaving just those last three provisions. Yeah, we included the dash 3s in your packet, so they should be in there. I know we have a number of bills and a number of amendments, so they're pretty brief.
Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Stembridge, please make it clear in August what your new court trip changes are. I know you and I talked about it, and I got myself.
Yes, if you look at the bill itself on from between lines 12 and 16, those are the lines that describe the current language limiting portraits, and I'll just read it real quickly here. It says a portrait submitted for inclusion in the voter's pamphlet shall not A. include the hands or anything held in the hands of the candidate, B. show the candidate wearing a judicial robe, a hat, or a military, police, or fraternal uniform, and C. show the uniform or insignia of any organization. That is current language. Senate Bill 137 proposes to remove that language. The Dash 3 amendment restores that language, so the limitations would continue in law if you adopt the Dash 3 amendments and pass out the thing.
Senator Bryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stembridge, the change of the word from shall to may, in line 12 in the restored language, is that a substantive change? Is that strictly to
I think that Senator Beyer and Kutcher, I think that that is just the form and style. I think that falls into the category that the Legislative Council has talked about, change in grammar.
Madam Chair?
Senator Beyer.
You being the legal mind on the committee.
Such as it is.
Has there been any challenge or any... Since we've been doing this now for about 4 years, changing may, shall not, and the Legislative Council has been telling us all along that they interpret that to have the same meaning. It's a new style of writing. Do you know if there's been any legal challenges to that as to whether or not the courts have agreed with the Legislative Council?
Senator Beyer, I am not aware of any. I'm assuming that those would be heard through the Senate Judiciary Committee, but I am not aware of any legal challenges on this issue. Senator Burdick.
No, Madam Chair. There's been nothing in judiciary, to my knowledge, on this issue.
Thank you.
Please.
Move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 137.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 137. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Unless you want to take, give us that little compromise, I suppose.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. I think we should quit while we're ahead. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? His amendment is approved. Senator Beyer.
Senate Bill 137 as amended by the committee to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 137 as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll? Okay.
Yes.
Senator Byers?
Aye.
Senator Burnett?
Aye.
Senator Quino?
Aye.
Senator Quino?
Aye.
Chair
Brown?
Chair Brown. We got transferred from that committee many weeks ago. So.
Brown votes aye.
We practiced, but we just had to do this.
I just thought we should do it. Okay. Senate Bill 137, having received unanimous support of the committee, is approved. Senator Beyer, would you like to be the carrier?
I'd be honored.
Okay. Thank you for volunteering. All right. Open a work session on Senate Bill 141.
Madam Co-Chair, you also considered this on the 6th of February. This prohibits undue influencing a person to sign, refrain from signing an initiative, referendum, or recall position. It authorized public distribution by candidates or political groups of items of less than $1 in value. In other words, it places a value on in the current language. It also limits the amount of food and beverages to be provided at a political gathering in support or opposition to a candidate, political committee, or measure to $3 per person. You have two amendments on this one. Number the dash one amendment would delete the application of this undue influence provision to the petition signature gathering for initiatives, referendums, and recalls. Your dash two deletes the language proposed in the bill relating to defining food and beverage. It restores the current refreshments incidental wording.
Let's see, my recollection, Mr. Stembridge, is the dash two folks have agreed upon that language. Is that correct?
It's my understanding that the bill was brought by the Secretary of State to provide what they call a bright line on the food issue and on the giveaway issue, and that by retaining the $1 provision, you have put that that bright line into the giveaway portion of it. You, by adopting the dash two amendment, you would return to the undefined refreshments incidental language.
Okay.
Senator Beyer is the one that asked us to draft the dash one.
The dash one amendments. Senator Beyer, do you wish to discuss the dash one amendments?
I'm practically trying to remember what they do.
Let me explain. Okay.
You want me to explain again? There's a minor provision in the bill. Well, it's minor in the terms of the number of words that it uses. It's on page 1, line 21. It says, sign or refrain from signing an initiative, referendum, or recall petition. It just applies the undue influence to that political activity, where this particular undue influence statute did not apply to signature gathering and does not apply to signature gathering. This line would make it apply to signature gathering. The dash one amendment would take this line out.
Mm-hmm. On what the dash two line 20.
Given that we're going to have to spend a little time on this bill, I'm going to close the public the work session on this one, and let's think about it for some time period, and then come back to it later today if we want to.
Okay.
I think it's going to take a few moments.
Sure.
So I'm going to close the work session on this one, Senate Bill 141, and open a work session on Senate Bill 319, which I think we're all in accord on.
Madam Co-Chair and members, Senate Bill 319 relates to write-in candidates, successful write-in candidates. You may recall you had two bills that you discussed on the 20th of February, 319 and 318, having to do with successful write-in candidates and the deadlines and financial statements that they would be required to file and meet. The dash 3 amendment that you have for Senate Bill 319 takes all of Senate Bill 318 and puts it in to 319. And basically what the amendment does, it combines 319 with 319-2, 318, and 318-1. Removes the recount provisions in 319. It sets a deadline for candidates nominated via write-in to file statements of economic interest.
Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Stembridge, could you remove recount provisions? Could you refresh this before?
Yes, on the if you have the original bill, It's section 6 on page 3, bottom of page 3. You'll see in the case of a recount involving candidate nominated or elected by write-in votes, your 3 removes that section.
I think that would be helpful, actually. Is that you, Mr. Lindbach? Why don't you come on up? So they must have to vote against you.
Either you're going to share my embarrassment or bail me out, right?
I think we need to know why the recount provisions need to be removed with regards to write-in candidates.
We requested from Senator Walker, the sponsor of the bill, that this be removed because it was establishing a different deadline for recounts under this circumstance than other deadlines, and it was unnecessary to do that.
Okay.
We just would like to keep the deadlines the same.
Okay. So under this amendment and this bill, the recount process would be the same for write-in candidates as it isn't for any other candidate.
That's correct.
Mr. Senator Atkinson.
Since you're here, could you just give us a for instance on the deadline that was being posted on a write-in?
Well, in Section 10, it says, in the case of a recount involving a candidate nominated or elected by write-in votes, the first demand shall be filed in the Office of the Secretary of State not later than the 55th day after the election. And the normal deadline for requesting a recount for the looking it up. We went through this. It's going to do often. Can we come back to that?
Sure.
Okay. I'll be embarrassed with you.
I'll be right there.
Okay.
So the -3 replaced the -2. Is that what it means?
Yes. And essentially it combines Senate Bill 319 and 318 into one bill,
which would be known as 319.
The committee will be at ease for a moment. For those of you who are here on Senate Bill 102,
ORS 5861, the deadline says that the first demand shall be filed in the Office of the Secretary of State not later than the 35th day, and a supplemental demand not later than the 45th day after the date of the election in which the votes were cast. This created different deadlines, and it's not necessary to do that. And we'd like to keep our deadlines the same wherever possible to create less confusion with the county clerks out there.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes. Thank you.
Did you have another question?
I sure did.
Sarah Atkinson, go for it.
Frickin' right up for you there, Madam Chair. And could you just walk us through one more part of this bill, which would be, again, give us a timeline for writing. I mean, I forget where it is in this bill, but under this bill, what would be the deadline for writing in, let's say, general election? So we get past the primary in May.
Right. Under the bill, it's not later than the 45th day after the election. If the individual accepts the nomination, the individual shall sign and file the form. And right now there is no deadline, which means that you can get close to the election and the political party and a candidate, the political party doesn't know whether a candidate's going to follow through or not. The candidate could withdraw or not accept. It's frustrating for the parties. It's also frustrating for the candidate that person will be running against because they don't know whether or not they have an opponent.
Sir, I can say.
I've been there. I've lived it. That's why I'm curious. So under this bill, just rough numbers, the primary occurs in May.
Yes.
And the timeline to find a write-in candidate for whatever reason, for whatever party, would essentially elapse in the end of June.
Right. This is a circumstance where a write-in wins the primary, but they haven't accepted the nomination.
Okay.
Follow me? And so they're given 45 days from the date of the election to accept the nomination.
But so the situation that I just described is not addressed in this bill, unfortunately.
That's correct.
Well, we need another amendment.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Lindbach. Okay. Do you feel your questions are fully answered?
Madam Chair, I do.
Thanks, Senator Atkinson. Okay, we are in work session.
Madam Chair, I would move that we adopt the Dash 3 amendments.
To Senate Bill 319, Senator Clarno has moved that we adopt the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 319. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? It is so ordered. Senator Clarno.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 319 to the floor as amended with the DuPass recommendation.
Senator Clarno has moved Senate Bill 319 as amended to the Senate floor with the DuPass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? It's so ordered. Who would like to be the carrier?
No, that's Senator Walker.
Okay. Senator Walker will be the carrier.
Sure.
Okay. It's my understanding the Voter Education Project has a presentation for us. Would those folks like to come on forward? Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Could you please identify yourselves for the record?
Yes. My name is Jeannie Berg, and I'm the Executive Director of the Voter Education Project.
My name is Patty Wentz. I'm the Communications Director for the Voter Education Project.
And we're here today to talk to you about some of the things we found while the project was active during the last signature gathering cycle, and also to testify in support of the four measures that are before you, which are 680, 706, 678, and 780. And I think you will have, there were two packets of information. One has the testimony on top, and one has our logo on top.
And I'm going to open public hearings on Senate Bill 780, 706, 680, and 678.
Thank you. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Voter Education Project is a nonprofit watchdog group, and we observed the signature gathering process in Oregon last year. We watched signature gathering on the street. We talked to people whose signatures were forged and who were tricked into signing things they did not support. And we observed the verification process, both at the Secretary of State's office and in the county clerk's offices. And over the course of last summer, we saw things that disturbed us. There was a disturbingly high level of forgery, fraud, and corruption in the initiative system overall, and more than we anticipated. We had expected to find some, but we were surprised. So we ended up filing complaints against 15 petitioners for everything from forgery and fraud to bribery and blatantly misleading voters about the content of initiatives. We've provided all of you with a report of what we've learned, and a summary of the complaints against the petitioners is in that. What we believe after all this is that unfortunately in Oregon, fraud's become the norm, not the exception, when it comes to signature gathering. And anybody who's spent time like we have with mercenary petitioners can confirm that it's an underground, cutthroat economy, and it's driven by the dollar. And it's not, as some people say, a few bad apples who commit fraud. Some of the most prolific signature gatherers for campaigns were the exact same petitioners against whom we filed citizen complaints. And the impact of these petitioners on the system is dramatic. Also disturbing is the fact that more than half of the petitioners the Voter Education Project filed complaints against already had criminal records for things like assault, repeated drug possession, trespassing, and harassment. And when the state's top petitioners are known criminals who are under investigation for initiative fraud, it's clear that we have a problem. Fraud and forgery have completely diseased the initiative system. Happily, it's a disease that we believe can be cured. And the key to stopping forgery and fraud is simply to take away the incentive and limit the opportunity. Now, we strongly believe that Senate Bills 780, 706, 680, and 678 will do that. We're going to tell you just a little bit about why. Senate Bill 780 directs the chief petitioner of an initiative to turn in each signature sheet not later than 90 days after the first signature on the sheet is obtained. This bill is important because it lessens the opportunity for forgery. Currently, circulators can hold onto sheets indefinitely. To use an example, let's say I'm a professional petitioner. I hit the street early when there's just a couple of campaigns going on. I get signatures. I throw them in the back of my car. The signature season goes on. I get a few more initiatives. And there's a strong incentive for me, instead of going out in the weather and collecting more signatures, to just copy them off the ones I've already got in the back of my car. And we know that happened. Of course, in 2000, there was a petitioner who was convicted of forgery, and they had traced signatures from older petitions onto a newer one. We believe that Senate Bill 780 limits the opportunity for that. Now, Senate Bill 706 requires the signer to fill in all the information on the initiative petition, not just the signature. This bill, too, will take away the opportunity for fraud and forgery, but instead of telling you why, I'm going to show you why. And we have a video. On the video are James Gerga and Paul Frankel. These are the two petitioners who, thanks to video evidence provided by the Voter Education Project, were convicted in 2001 and 2002 of forging signatures. And so this will take just a minute. We hope. Well, I think, there we go. Just a second, we'll get to the right place. What you'll be seeing is Frankel and Gerga had what on the top of their petitions a gas tax petition. Now, there was no petition about the gas tax in Oregon last year. This was a petition they made up. Now, as you see, the woman has already signed that top petition. What's happening now is Jim Gerga is doing two people at once, and he's flipping the petition sheet over just far enough that they can put their signature on. They can't actually even read what's on the top of the petition. When we talked to people after they'd signed these petitions, most had no idea they'd even signed initiative petitions, much less anything about what any of them were about. They thought they'd signed five copies of a gas tax petition. Frankel and Gerga admitted to using this scam in Oregon, and in fact had written about using the same scam in California prior to this. And so the interesting thing is what they've done then is they take the name and the address that's on the fake petition on top, and then they've got just the signatures on the others, and then they hire what are called writers to fill in the rest of the information and copy it from the top petition onto the ones below it. That's why when you looked at that, you would see that on the subsequent petitions below that, there is nothing but the signature on any of them, not the date, not the printed name, not the address or anything. And in fact, on the one that's being signed now, if you noticed, and we just missed it, she only put her name on the top petition. Later in the video, and we're not going to show it that far, but if you want copies, we can get those to you, you see them making up an address for her and putting it on the top gas tax petition so their writers have something to copy onto the ones below. What we found out is this type of misleading is very common in Oregon. The Voter Education Project filed complaints against six petitioners after we found that the signatures on measures they, after voters found their signatures on measures they did not know they'd signed and did not support. We found this in particular early on with petitions on the death penalty measure. People are very clear about whether they support that or not. And so people who did not support a repeal of it were shocked to find their signature on that measure. And it's because they had been misled in that very fashion. And so in your packet, there are two letters, and that's the packet that the testimony is on the top of, from signers who responded to a letter from us and wrote about their experience with petitioners. Last year, something interesting happened. Often these writers that are hired are teens, and often they are too young to be working. It's a part of this underground kind of economy. In your packet is also a police report from a Portland police officer. He was called on a call about a runaway, and it was a 14-year-old kid whose job was to be a writer. He was living in a hotel with a petitioner, and they caught them, you know, in a circle filling out information on petitions, and that police report is enclosed. The going rate for writers is about 7 to 10 cents a signature. They think they're making pretty decent money at 10 cents a signature. They get that just for filling the information in. So you can imagine in this kind of situation, the rules are pretty flexible and forgery is common. Petitioners whose names are on the bottom often will blame the writer for forgeries on the page, and there's no way to really pinpoint who did forge a signature once you've identified it as a forgery. And so another problem with these is that the signature gatherers often write the wrong name in, or the writers do, beside a signature, and what happens is that signature ends up being invalid because they use the printed name often the county clerks do to look up a signature. They look up the wrong signature, of course they don't match, and they end up with an invalid signature. So it actually hurts the proponents of initiatives as well when writers are irresponsible. We would support actually an amendment to this bill as well, and we realized later on that it might need an amendment to allow people who are unable to fill in the information because of a physical disability, allow the signature gatherers to fill those in. So in that situation, we're okay with that. Senate Bill 680 is the next one, and that gives the Secretary of State the authority to remove initiative petitions from consideration if the circulator was convicted of forgery in that election cycle. This bill reduces both the incentive to commit forgery and any incentive to hire already convicted forgers. Last year, you know, there were two forgers convicted. They had gathered over 30,000 signatures on four different initiatives before they were convicted, and they admitted to state investigators that possibly as many as 90% of the signatures were bad that they collected. Under Oregon law, those could have been turned in and could have been counted. Fortunately, the chief petitioners were responsible in this situation and did not try to turn those in. But we think that once a signature gatherer has been convicted of forgery, you really can't trust what they do. They sign what is essentially a contract. At the bottom of the petition, when they say they attest that they saw these signatures signed, they attest that they believe them to be good. If they forge signatures, they falsified that contract as well. And we believe that nothing they do should then be trusted in terms of signature gathering. We believe the system hinges on the honesty of petition circulators. Now, the next one, Senate Bill 678, may seem like just a little thing, but it actually is quite important. It requires the circulator of initiative petition to witness the signing of the sheet by an elector. Now, you may think that's already how it is with Oregon law. Oregon law simply says that the sheet must be signed in the presence of the circulator. That's been construed to mean, both by investigators in the AG's office and circulators on the street, that the circulator doesn't necessarily have to be the one there talking to the signer. They can be just kind of in the vicinity. And so what's happened is there were several circulators this time around who led crews. They would have four or five people working with them. They'd be on two different ends of the entrance to the Walmart, and they might be able to be called over if there was some kind of problem, but they certainly didn't witness the interaction with the signer. And yet that was okay. And we don't believe that should be okay. A number of other states in their law are more specific than we are in saying that the circulator must actually witness the signature being affixed to the paper. So we believe we could have better enforcement around the whole notion that the circulator must also, you know, actually be the one circulating the petition if we had this little change in language. And the other thing that happened this year was the crews that worked with those circulators essentially circulated anonymously. They didn't sign out on any of the petitions, and yet they were the ones having the primary interaction with the signer. And I think what we've determined in Oregon over time with the way our laws is was that circulating anonymously wasn't okay. And yet it happens simply because our language isn't quite as tight as it should be. Are there any questions? Thank you for your time.
Actually, I have a question. On the
The actual initiative sheet, can we just take a look at that? I noticed the second signature, Deborah Hopkins, is pretty easy to read. Mm-hmm. It looks to me, obviously, like somebody copied that signature afterward. They didn't even spell the name right.
Right.
I'm assuming that's one of the issues you're trying to get at.
Right.
Okay. The last signature, 20, I cannot read that. I don't know how anybody possibly could have. Maybe on the original it was more clear, but how could they have possibly known that that was Ms. Roach's signature? I mean...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what would happen is if they had a top petition like the gas tax one we saw, Paula Roach would have written her own name on the top petition.
Okay.
And then they would have copied from her printing.
Okay.
But what happens is often they do copy it wrong. You know, it may be something entirely different.
Okay.
And that was a problem, and I actually think John Limbach may be prepared to tell you about some of the things they ran into with signatures that were difficult to verify because of writers.
And my other question is, how did you videotape this? I mean...
Oh, yeah. You want to know? Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we were at Lloyd Center, and as you know, Lloyd Center is a three-story mall. Petitioners are positioned on the second floor, and there is a balcony that overlooks them. And so we positioned ourselves above them, essentially, and a little off to the side with a fairly strong zoom lens, and just watched from about 20, 30 feet above.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I may interject, the petitioners knew that we were there. We were not hiding. They knew that we were there.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Regarding Senate Bill 706, I tend to be kind of naive sometimes, but in 2000, when I was circulating my petition to require background checks at gun shows, it was a very popular petition, especially in the city of Portland. And one day, a person who later the newspaper identified as working for Bill Sizemore in his petition gathering operation came to our campaign and offered to sell us 1,000 signatures that he had gathered for our measure. And I was very perplexed by that because Bill Sizemore had come out publicly against my measure and indeed had sometimes had a booth at the gun show, I had heard. So he was a pretty strong opponent of my measure. So I was perplexed to see that he was circulating my petition. But the petition was very, very popular. And and somehow this person had gotten hold of our forms, which apparently is illegal in itself. But we ended up threatening to file charges against that person for trying to market signatures, basically. And we ended up getting the signatures for free. There were about 1,000 of them. And they were, we analyzed and we ran them through our fairly rigorous petition, you know, signature review process. And there was no evidence of people copying the addresses or any of the things I see on this. These were real legitimate looking signatures. And we even cross-checked some of them to see what the quality was like. And they were just about the same as anybody else would get. Now, given what we just saw, would you think that this might be an example of someone who was using a popular petition for purposes of gaining a signature to copy on other petitions?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, we certainly saw that in a more liberal part of town. If they were standing in front of Nature's, signature gatherers would invariably lead off with something like the GMO measure. If they were in a more conservative area, they would lead off with a more conservative measure. Invariably, though, all 12 measures that were circulating, liberal and conservative, would be underneath that one. And it was, you know, they learn to read the place where they are, read the crowd that they're dealing with, and sell them on the initiative that they think they'll respond to. I certainly saw that in 1996 when I worked on the minimum wage campaign. That was a popular initiative, and in a lot of areas, it was a lead.
they would, yeah,
right.
So they would lead off with that. Even if they had to obtain the forms, which
right.
is, if, as I understand it, illegal. I mean, as we looked into this, we found a number of illegal activities involved just in what we knew.
Right.
And I'd never heard of a rider at that point.
We heard of instances where signature gatherers actually offered money to signature gatherers who were working on the minimum wage and the Initiative Integrity Act because they wanted to use the minimum wage petition as a lead and they couldn't get a hold of it any other way. So they attempted to get it from other petitioners on the street.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions? Senator Atkinson, any questions?
I had a comment, but I'll answer it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. Senator Devlin, if you're hearing this committee, if you are listening to this, please come on up. We'd like to have you come testify at this point in time.
Any other legislators?
You can also call Senator
Devlin. Okay. Let's go ahead and call Senator Devlin.
Yeah, I've got this one at 780.
I'm sorry?
I've got this one at 780.
Okay. Do you want to come down?
Sure.
Okay. So we've had a public hearing open for 678, 680, 706, and 780. We're going to continue with that with Senator Burdick's testimony and hoping that Senator Devlin will arrive.
Okay. Want to grill the witness?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeannie Burdick. I'm a state senator from District 18. Senate Bill 780 directs chief petitioners of state initiative petitions to file signature sheets with the Secretary of State not later than 90 days after the first signature is obtained on the signature sheet. Many initiatives are approved for circulation over a year ahead of the deadline for submission. During circulation, signature gatherers are out on the street collecting valuable personal information from voters, then letting this information sit in boxes in the backs of cars, as we've heard, in hotel rooms and who knows where else. As additional initiatives are approved for circulation, signature gatherers have access to hundreds of valuable signatures that with very little effort can be forwarded onto each new initiative approved for circulation. What better role for the legislature than to protect Oregonians from this potential signature theft? Currently, an expectation is placed on the Secretary of State to investigate abuses in the circulation of initiatives. With the current 30-day timeline for initiative submission and certification, there's little time to complete signature verification, much less investigate fraud. A quantitative analysis of petition sheets is possible within 30 days, but a qualitative analysis that could protect electors from signature theft is often not as thorough due to the lack of time. Requiring signatures to be turned in within 90 days gives the Secretary of State time to further investigate their own concerns with petition sheets as well as pursue complaints filed regarding the circulation of the initiative. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, I might just add that one of my reasons for getting involved in the initiative reform process is I am a chief petitioner. I use the process to great benefit, I believe, for my agenda and for the people of Oregon to advance an issue that was not able to make it through this process. My litmus test for any reform measure is to have the measure clean up abuses in the process without interfering with legitimate citizens who want to redress the government, which I believe the initiative process was intended to do. As a chief petitioner who had to gather 92,000 signatures in 85 days because of the delays of court challenges, I will have to say that Senate Bill 780 meets my litmus test of not making any difference in my ability as a citizen petitioner to get something on the ballot. I don't think it's at all unreasonable or onerous to require chief petitioners to turn their signatures in periodically where they will become public records subject for either side of the debate to analyze and to check for fraud. I believe we'll all benefit from having these public records open to the public and also protected within the confines of the Secretary of State's office. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Senator. Fantastic written testimony. Thank you. 85 days. This is an area of the initiative reform process that I just don't. I'm really trying to learn the history on. You had, by the time you got through the whole court process, all the stuff that we were trying to address, I think in 102, you're trying to address in 102. How come there's only 85 days?
This was because of my insufficiencies, my lack of experience as a petitioner. I should have started this petition way sooner than I did, especially since I started out as a volunteer campaign. I started late. I was held up for 3 months by court challenges and challenges to the ballot title. So that was the number of days. And because of that, I would not have personally been affected because we were just scrambling to get those signatures. But if I had done it, given myself more time, it would definitely have made no difference to me, to our campaign, to have them turned in regularly.
See, this is I didn't mean for you to tell you. I have to put on the record that it took a while to get
everything well
going.
Known, Mr.
But one of the problems that I have in the current process is that we have a false deadline. I have to go back to what's on the mall, and on the mall there's one of the bricks out there that talks about Oregon, I think 1919 beginning this citizen process. But if you look back to what the original intent was, and hopefully by the time we talk about 102 and wherever it ends up, I want to know why is there a false deadline put upon the time that it takes to gather the signatures? In so doing, if you can't begin to, if you can't let an idea boil, if you can't let an idea gain momentum, and you're under this gun because if you don't get it on, you've qualified for this general election, and that's it. I'm wondering if that's a false deadline. And that is to say, you had an idea. You've got the whole ballot title process. You got a ballot title. It took a long time. It was painful for a whole variety of reasons, hopefully, of which we'll fix. But then, I don't think, as a citizen, you should be pushed into that 85 days. If your idea has merit, which we all believe ideas that go through this process have the opportunity to be aired if they are of merit or are not of merit, I believe you should have time to let that idea brew, regardless of what the idea is. You should have time, not a false 85 days or a deadline of a pending general election, but if it takes 2 or 3 years to allow something to gain public either public support or to do it the right way rather than this pressure cooker of doing it falsely or creating a mini industry as the previous testimony showed. I really have a hard time with that. Do you see what I'm saying with that deadline?
Yeah, I do see what you're saying, and this is, of course, a different issue than is addressed by this bill.
Sorry.
But I also think there are concerns about the integrity of the process. We live in a mobile society, and if there were a very prolonged period of time, then you'd have people moving out of state. You'd have people changing counties. There could be some logistical problems. Again, that's a different issue than this bill. I certainly would have accepted an extension in a heartbeat at the time. But I think I will have to say honestly that there was enough time for me as a chief petitioner to have adequate time to get that measure on the ballot. I believe in my case, because I wanted the legislative process to reach an end on this particular issue, and that did cost some time. So it was a legitimate trade-off in my case, but if I just wanted to get an initiative on the ballot, I had adequate time to do it, in my view.
Any other questions for Senator Burdick? Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to see you in front of us.
Senator
Devlin, you're here on Senate Bill 678 and 680.
Yes, Madam Chair. What would be your preference that I start with?
We're on public hearing on all of those. Start wherever you wish, please.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will start numerically then and start with SB 678. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm here to testify on behalf of this bill. It's a very targeted, very narrow scope bill, SB 678 directs circulator of election petitions, including initiative, referendum, and recall petitions, to certify that the circulator witnessed the signing of the petition signature sheet by each individual whose name appears on the signature sheet. Currently, the circulator's certification section of a signature sheet reads, I hereby certify every person who signed this sheet did so in my presence, and I believe each person is a qualified voter in the state of Oregon. SB 678 replaces that language with language that states the circulator witnessed the signing of the signature sheet by each individual whose signature appears on the signature sheet and believes each individual to be elector. It might seem like a small distinction, but it's a significant distinction in terms of actual oversight of the signature process. This bill's concept was brought to me by the Voter Education Project and reflects concerns raised by investigators regarding the definition of presence versus witnessing a signature. Are you present when a signature sheet is over on the other side of the mall? You're within the mall, but are you actually present at the time of the signature? Or would it be better that you witnessed it so that you actually had some degree of personal knowledge of who was signing it and what their qualifications were to sign it? This language directly mirrors language from California statute as applies to witnessing signatures. This may appear to be a relatively minor amendment to current statute, but I think it's an important amendment in terms of ensuring the validity and the integrity of the initiative and recall and referendum process. Phase two, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 680. Senate Bill 680 prohibits consideration of state initiative, referendum, or recall petition signature sheets certified by petition circulator if circulator has been convicted, underlying has been convicted, of attempting to obtain signatures on circulating or filing petition knowing it to contain false signature or making false statement, oath, or affidavit under election laws, i.e., somebody that has been convicted in this process of already falsifying information, already conducting fraudulent activities in terms of what happens to their signature sheets that they've already submitted. SB 680 gives the Secretary of State the authority to remove petition sheets when the circulator is convicted of forgery on that particular initiative. So it's initiative specific. During the 2002 election, two signature gatherers were convicted of forgery on petition sheets. Paul Frankel and James Gerga, I think you probably saw the video that was probably showed here earlier, admitted to fraud so pervasive that Frankel stated his validity rate was somewhere in the single digits, and Gerga had noted that at least half the signatures he gathered were fraudulent. Yet the Secretary of State did not have the authority to remove those signature sheets if they had been turned in. Finally, this taints the legitimacy of our initiative process. It is our role, I believe, as legislators, to protect the public from unknowingly having their signature count toward the certification of an initiative. These are two relatively narrowly focused legislative measures, both of which I think will improve the integrity of the initiative recall and referendum process in the state.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Anybody have any questions for Senator Devlin? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure, Madam Chair.
And on deck, Senator Ryan Deckert. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 565. Good afternoon, Senator Deckert.
Good afternoon. Do you have our testimony?
Can I bring up my whole crew on this? Or,
sure.
Crew? No, but you're on this one.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate Rules Committee, I would first...
Just a minute. Committee members, don't we require Senate members, male Senate members, to wear a tie in front of this committee? No.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson?
I sent Senator Deckert a note saying that I thought we should call the Sergeant of Arms and have him removed as a hostile witness for lack of attention to the dress code.
Madam Chair, I'm putting that note back together as we speak. I did not exactly say that.
Senator Beyer.
I guess I would argue that with the exception of the lack of tie, which I know that the Senate President was not wearing this morning when he first got here, he's got his Senate President costume on today.
Mm-hmm. So we should let him proceed?
Yes.
Okay.
Senator Beyer.
Can't argue
no authority.
I was waiting for Senator Beyer to admonished me for my clothing or my dress code, but I'm glad that he opted not to this afternoon.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate Rules Committee, you have my testimony, and I will carefully and slowly, it's 4 or 5 pages long, so I will verbatim read it without looking up at the committee, and I will do it in a slow and very methodical manner. This issue actually is very, very simple, and it's very straightforward, and I think it's one that actually demands and the person seated to my right and left can give a great deal more information about it. To me, it's one that really does demand attention, though. And I think the one thing that I would point out to this committee is ballot measure 66 is the one that, at least for me, highlights this issue. And it's as simple as we offer voters in the caption of a ballot title a half choice. Ballot measure 66 read, do you want to put a portion? I'll read it. It was basically some or a portion of your lottery revenue into parks and salmon. What it did not obviously offer voters in the climate that we have with 26 ballot measures or 15 or 10, what it doesn't is give the implications of that decision. And so this Senate bill is a very simple and straightforward that we ought to offer voters the full choice and give them full range of options or a full definition of what they are voting on rather than, I think, with a crowded ballot. I think 66 is a good example. I think that by saying on that one that taking a portion of your lottery dollars and putting them in parks and salmon is a very good option, I think I voted for it, but it does not really give a full explanation of what that would do, which was to take money out of other programs. And I think voters, as we do down here, need to fully understand the choice that they have before them. And so this Senate bill would simply do just that. It would ensure that voters get the full choice, whether it is to cut spending or to raise spending or to divert spending.
Thank you. Mr. Novick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Novick, the legislative coordinator for the Department of Education, appearing for Superintendent Susan Castillo, who is a strong supporter of this bill. She sponsored a version of this bill in the last session, Senate Bill 464, and I noted that it's now 565. So we hope that it passes this session because of that rate. Next time it'll be 666. And nobody will want to touch it. As I once heard Bill Sizemore say, a ballot title is in effect a poll question. And we all know that there are fair poll questions and unfair poll questions. If you asked, who are you voting for governor, Kate Brown or Bev Clarno, that's a fair poll question. If you asked, who are you voting for governor, Kate Brown, a strong supporter of public education, or Bev Clarno, that would be an unfair poll question. If you asked, who are you voting for governor, Bev Clarno, who will hold the line against higher taxes, or Kate Brown, that would be an unfair poll question. The ballot titles that we have for initiatives that mandate spending without saying where the money comes from or that cut taxes are all of the unfair variety because they don't give the voters an idea of trade-offs. Pollster Lisa Grove said in a letter commenting on one ballot title a couple of years ago that unless a ballot title gives people a sense of trade-offs involved in financial measures, it is inherently biased. And as it stands now, the ballot titles for tax cut and spending mandate measures essentially ask the voters questions like this. Hey, do you want a tax cut? Or, hey, do you want to spend money on cool stuff? And two real-life examples, one that Senator Deckard mentioned, the ballot title for Measure 66 in 1998 essentially asked the voters, hey, you think you want to give money to parks and salmon? Parks and salmon are cool. And you had to be a very careful reader of the result of no vote of that ballot title to understand that it had any impact on schools and economic development. And by the way, the only parts of the ballot title that appear on the ballots in most counties are the caption, the result of yes, and the result of no. So the fiscal impact and the summary that's 125 words generally voters don't see. The ballot title for Measure 91, Sizemore's big tax cut in 2000, it would have cut income tax revenue by about 20%, would have had a huge impact, obviously, in the major portions of the general fund, health care, education, public safety. You could read the ballot title without getting any sense of that. And Measure 565 would fix that. It would require honesty. It would require full disclosure. It would say that the three services that currently get the most money from the affected revenue source, such as for the general fund, education, public safety, health care. You'd have to list that in the ballot title and say, reduces funding available for, and list those services. Not reduces funding for, because there could be other factors, but reduces funding available for. Senate Bill 565 would not be so necessary if all voters carried around in their heads a picture of the state budget. And already knew these trade-offs. But we know from polling data that that's not the case. Regular people have better things to do with their lives than study the state budget. And as the Oregonian noted last week, in an editorial I've copied for you, a recent Progress Board survey stated that a recent Progress Board survey showed that less than a quarter of Oregonians are aware, for instance, that education is the largest item in the state general fund. So if there's a measure which would divert or cut part of the general fund, many voters do not automatically know that that's likely to have an impact on education. And by the way, the same fact that people don't know where their tax dollars go is true at the federal level. I've attached an article from 1994 in the New York Times on how few people understand that the biggest item in the federal budget, for instance, is Social Security. So a major reason for the need for this measure, this Senate bill, is that folks don't know off the top of their heads how the budget is spent now, so if a measure affects the budget, they don't necessarily know what the implications of that are. I think that Senator Decker is right in saying that Measure 66 is a prime example of how dangerous it is to have ballot titles that are inherently biased in favor of a spending mandate or a tax cut. Measure 66 dedicated 15% of lottery funds to parks and salmon, which sounded fine to most people. I think that there will come a time when everybody realizes that's a great way to do business, and let's do a measure that dedicates 35% of the general fund to education, and then next year one that dedicates 30% to the environment, and the next year 40% to health care, and pretty soon we'll be up to 150%, and it'll be up to the legislature to deal with that. And when you say we can't allocate 150% of the budget, then people will tell you, well, you know, coaches are able to get athletes to give 150%, so by God, you should be able to get that budget to give 150%. And I think that it's only if we have ballot titles that give voters a sense of the real choices for them that we can avoid that kind of a constitutional crisis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Novick. Ms. Leonard.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kristen Leonard with the Oregon Education Association. I've got written testimony here I'll turn in. I don't want to spend a lot of time reading it because basically these folks have already covered our interest in it. I did write on my testimony that as an organization that periodically participates in the initiative process, we're interested in this. A bit of an understatement. I mean, we really believe that this is just a good government fix to something that is a problem right now. Giving voters more information is always a good thing, and having them understand some of the intricacies about these budget decisions we think is very important. So, great. Any questions?
Questions? Thank you. Ms. Leonard, I might have you stay there. I'm going to have Mr. Nesbitt come up and join you on Senate Bill 706.
I'd like to repeat my testimony. Senator Clarno missed my testimony. I thought this was the better testimony I've given.
I'm sorry. I will read it. Okay.
Senator Meyer. I can really use another nap.
Ooh. And then on deck, Dan Meek and Jason Williams, and in the hole, John Lindback, for whatever bills you want to testify on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Over the last several election cycles, I've been involved with a number of measures, from the drafting, filing, circulating, qualifying, and passing, actually of four different ballot measures, measures 62 and 63 in 1998, and measures 25 and 26 in 2002. And in that process have been myself a chief petitioner on one of those. I also have had the experience of seeing the Voter Education Project in action, and at one point being alerted by one of their staffers that last year about this time, someone was found in Hawthorne in Portland circulating a petition for our Initiative Integrity Act. That was a measure, since passed by the voters as Measure 26, which prohibited paying by the signature on initiative petitions. And we were trying our best to tightly control the signature collection for that initiative because we didn't want to pay by the signature. And in fact, those we were paying, they were both volunteers and paid staff, were being paid a salary and getting health benefits and under the supervision of supervisors. But somehow or other, one of these professional petitioners was carrying our petition, and I ended up confronting this person, telling him I was the chief petitioner, that he wasn't authorized to carry petition sheets for my measure. And he kind of stood his ground and said, I can circulate this whenever I want to. And when I demanded that he turn over the petition to me because I was the chief petitioner, he refused. He did show me the petition sheet. And significantly for what Senate Bill 706 would propose, on that sheet were nothing but signatures. No dates, no addresses, no names. And if I can call your attention back to the very signature sheet you were looking at in the Voter Education Project's packet, I think, Senator Brown, you were asking about how can anybody read these names. It's Paula Roach, line 20. Well, I think that name was just randomly matched against that signature because look at line 17. There's Paula Roach's name, but it's crossed out. So somebody was trying to match names and addresses against signatures, and I really doubt, based on my experience confronting some of these circulators and even looking at evidence like this submitted by the Voter Education Project, that these people knew what they were signing. In many cases, my understanding is they're being told they were signing extra copies of the same petition. And these signatures are less likely to represent an informed signature than those where somebody is actually shown a sheet and expected to fill in all the information. This is the harvesting of signatures that's going on the streets, and I think it's leading to misinformation and outright deception when it comes to collecting signatures. I would just add one other observation, because as a result of my experience, I ended up filing a complaint with the Secretary of State's office, and they ended up telling me there wasn't much they could do about it. I really think we need to pay attention to the fact that these signatures are every bit as important as signatures on a ballot. This process on the front end of the initiative process is meant to determine the will of the voters, whether there's sufficient interest from the voters in going through the whole process of putting something on the ballot and asking for the electorate at large to vote on it. And just as we're very careful about how signatures are checked and, first of all, applied and checked to a ballot that's mailed in, I think we need to be every bit as careful about the front end of this process and treat the signature circulator, the petition circulator, as in effect an agent of the Secretary of State, somebody out there collecting signatures as part of our electoral process. And the way it's handled now, these people are out there harvesting signatures, misinforming voters, not being held to the most basic rules of accountability that provides for a process with integrity and a process with validity and a process with accuracy. So I am here in support of all three of the bills before you, Senate Bill 780, 706, 680, and 678. I think each one of them accomplishes a particular and important improvement and safeguard for our process, and we're very much interested not in any way retarding the collection of signatures, but making sure that it's done accurately and fairly and with proper representation of the initiatives for which people are collecting signatures. Thank you.
Again, Kristen Leonard with the Oregon Education Association. Submitting written testimony from AFL-CIO, the Oregon Education Association, and the Service Employees Union in support of all four bills, 780, 706, 680, and 678. And, again, this just kind of fits within our parameters of what we consider important initiative reform that protects the voters and the electorate in this process that we feel is very sacred to the changes in policy in Oregon. We feel it's important that they have the right, the electorate has the right to bring these kinds of changes to the government, but at the same time we believe that they need to be protected. Their signatures, their personal information needs to be protected, and we feel these bills do that. So.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, in your experience as a chief petitioner, didn't you find that when people were signing the petition in the course of signing it and filling out their address and taking that little bit of time on the petition that they'd sometimes want to discuss it and ask some details about what it did?
Madam Chair and Senator Burdick, definitely. Now, I personally, in the campaigns I've worked with, have never circulated more than two initiatives at a time. But in the last election cycle, I was carrying both the minimum wage petitions and the initiative integrity petitions. Each one led to a separate conversation. And sometimes a voter would sign one and not the other, sign A and not B, or B and not A. But in each case, we had a separate conversation and took the time to discuss it and got the voter to sign all the information on the sheet.
I might just observe, whoever's left here, that in my petition, we were only carrying one. I think there may have been one group at one time that was carrying a couple of other ones, but we had to get them awfully, awfully fast in that very compressed time period, and I never felt that it would be a legitimate shortcut to take to ask people to just sign and run off. That you know, people were putting something controversial on the ballot. They deserved to know what it was they were signing and to take however much of time it took. And I didn't get everybody that way, but to take however much time it took so people could make an informed decision. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Any further comments? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Dan Meek.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dan Meek. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of Oregon Common Cause, which has been Oregon's citizen lobby for 30 years, and also for the Pacific Green Party. I'd like to focus on the bills that Oregon Common Cause, the State Board of Oregon Common Cause, voted to unanimously oppose at their last meeting. The first one is Senate Bill 706, which would prohibit anyone other than the individual signer from writing anything on the signature sheet. We think this would have two deleterious effects. First of all, it would increase the number of totally valid signatures that are thrown out for no good reason. Right now, conscientious signature gatherers will pre-validate their signatures by taking their signature sheets into the county election offices and looking up those voters' signatures on their computer systems. Oftentimes we find, however, you can't read a signature, you can't tell what name it is. And sometimes people print their names in a way that is also illegible. So it goes down to the address. Sometimes you can tell what the address is. Look up the address, look it up backwards to the name of the person, and then check that signature. Sometimes that takes quite a bit of time. It takes more time, we have found, than the county election offices are willing to put into verifying the signatures when they actually go to the county election offices to be verified. So what we do, and many other campaigns have done in the past, is if you have an illegible signature and an illegible printed name, and you determine what the actual name is, you print it in very small print above the illegible printed name. And that allows the county election officials to verify a valid signature instead of throwing it out. If no one else can write on the signature sheet, then you will simply be throwing out thousands of valid signatures. In addition, we think it would disenfranchise a significant portion of elderly and handicapped voters. It's often the elderly who don't legibly print their names or addresses. Sometimes they will have their addresses printed on cards or scraps of paper, like envelopes. You know, they'll show you their utility bill. And that, in that way, the circulator can write down the correct address and, in some cases, write down or print down the correct name. Often one spouse will fill in the address for both spouses because one spouse is no longer able to write or print legibly. This bill, for what we think is no good reason, would require the elderly and the handicapped to stand around and struggle to fill in their addresses, cities, state, zip codes, and precinct numbers. We don't think that there's absolutely any reason for doing this. Now, the Voter Education Project folks said that some paid circulators write in the wrong name. Well, the wrong name isn't even looked at as long as the signature is legible. And anyone who writes in or prints in the wrong name is just causing a signature to be invalid in the first place. The other bill that Common Cause and the Green Party strongly oppose is Senate Bill 780, which requires that every signature sheet be turned in within 90 days of the date of the first signature on it. We think this would destroy the initiative and referendum process for grassroots campaigns while leaving those campaigns that rely on paid circulators and big money virtually unaffected. A paid campaign can easily tell their paid circulators to turn in their signature sheets every 90 days or 80 days or 75 days or whatever processing time it takes. But a grassroots volunteer campaign simply can't do that. And there are members of the statewide Board of Common Cause who are Oregon's absolute all-time champions in collecting volunteer signatures. They go out and collect thousands of signatures, or tens of thousands of signatures among them, in every election cycle. It's already difficult enough when you have hundreds or, in some cases, thousands of volunteers all over the state to get the word out to the volunteers to turn in the signature sheets, even if they're not filled with 15 or 20 signatures. It's difficult enough to get that to happen by the end of June in an even-numbered year. Every volunteer, every campaign which depends substantially on volunteers finds that hundreds or even thousands of signatures come in to the mail, to the post office box, after the due date because people simply don't get the word, even though there's only one due date now. To have a rolling 90-day due date would, I believe, cause thousands or tens of thousands of signatures to be thrown away because it's not possible to get the word out to the volunteers, hey, you have to turn in your signatures every 3 months or every 2 months or on some other schedule. This is multiplied by the fact that in Oregon, when you sign a petition, you must sign the petition sheet with your county on it. If you sign any other sheet, it's invalid. Now, when I circulate petitions, even a single petition, I'm often carrying 15 different sheets so that I can accept signatures from people in 15 different counties. So what you're telling the volunteer who's collecting signatures is that you have to send in the sheets, even if you have only one signature on it, and you have to do this county by county. So you could be sending in hundreds of sheets with one or two signatures on them simply because that's all you have when the 80 or 90 day period expires. We see utterly no benefit to this requirement. In fact, we see that it would be counterproductive to the purpose that it's claimed for it. The purpose that is claimed for it somehow is that, oh, right now people collect signatures and they take the signature sheet and put it in the back of their car or something like that, and somehow this leads later to forgery. There's no rational basis for that statement, and in fact, I think this would make forgery easier. Number one, if someone's going to forge a signature under this bill, they've certainly got 90 days to do it. In fact, they have an infinite time period to do it because they can make a photocopy of the signature sheet and forge from that. So it's irrational. But second, this bill actually makes forgery easier because, as someone in testimony today mentioned, and as is mentioned in our written testimony, the signature sheets that are turned in to the Secretary of State or counties or whomever, or the Secretary of State, I would assume, for a statewide measure, become public record, which means anyone can go down and make a copy of them. I would rather have my signature sheets in my basement, even though they're more than 90 days old, than be turning in signature sheets to the Secretary of State that anyone in the state or outside the state can go to the Secretary of State's office, make a copy of it, and start forging signatures based upon the signature sheets that I've turned in advance. So I think this bill would be counterproductive to its stated purpose. On the other bills, Senate Bill 565, the groups I represent would support this, but only if it's amended so that the financial impact statement is a meaningful one and is not a misleading one. Under the bill as written, even if a measure had a $10 effect on state revenue, the Financial Impact Statement Committee, would have to make the list of up to three services that are affected by it. It's not printed in the voter's pamphlet unless it's $1 million annual impact, but nevertheless, the committee is required to make the list even if it has a $1 annual impact. And that report and that statement will, of course, be used by the opponents of a measure. And it can be used by the opponents of a measure that has virtually no financial impact at all. For example, we have a campaign finance reform measure that has been submitted for approval by the Secretary of State. It might have a financial impact because it requires more frequent reporting of campaign contributions and expenditures and more frequent publication of them by the Secretary of State. It might have an effect on state services, on costs of maybe $100,000 a year. Under this bill, our measure in the financial impact statement report would be tarred with the statement that this would reduce the amount of funds available for schools, public safety, and highways when the amount is completely inconsequential. That's why we suggest and would support this bill if the listing of the three services were limited to measures with an annual financial impact of $100 million. In a $10 billion biennial budget, you know, you're getting down to a 1% impact. If it's below 1%, then I think it's more misleading than useful to have the three services listed, because it takes virtually all measures and lumps them all together, and in fact would dilute the effect of listing the three services, because virtually every measure is going to have these three services listed, whether it has an infinitesimal financial impact or a large financial impact. Finally, on Senate Bill 680, the groups would support this, but only if it's amended. To begin with, it's a difficult question. It's a difficult issue. If you look at the signature sheets collected by persons who are convicted of forgery, there are still going to be signatures on those sheets that are valid signatures of valid registered voters. And I don't know that it's a good idea to disenfranchise them through no fault of their own. And remember, once you've signed a signature sheet, when it's offered to you by anyone who knows anything about Oregon's initiative process will know that you are highly discouraged from ever signing it again, because a duplicate signature in the first and second samples put together by the Secretary of State is counted against you to the extent of 400 signatures. You find a duplicate signature in the first and second sample combined, you subtract 400 off the top of your signature total. So people are discouraged from signing more than once, and if you happen to have your valid signature collected by someone who is later convicted of forgery, is it a good idea to disenfranchise you because of that? I'm not sure that it is. However, we think that this bill should have an additional provision, and which is that the Secretary of State should maintain a registry of persons who are convicted of forgery, so when these persons attempt to collect signatures for chief petitioners, the chief petitioners can know that these folks are not to be trusted and should not be allowed to collect signatures on these petitions. Finally, you know, collecting signatures is almost getting to be street warfare now. Because you not only have dedicated volunteers, hundreds or thousands of them, you do have mercenary paid signature collectors, and now you have on the streets groups of folks who approach people who are collecting signatures and hand out pamphlets, surround them, wear their, I don't even remember what color their shirts were, their red shirts or their green shirts or whatever they were. What we have been suggesting for 4 years now is to add a different process that might be able to substantially reduce or eliminate fraud and substantially reduce the cost of verifying signatures. And that we call that the initiative primary. And under this system, you could allow any initiative or petition to submit 10,000 valid signatures by February 1st of the election year. That would qualify the petition for the primary election ballot. Would also mean that the ballot title for that initiative would be printed in the voter's pamphlet for the primary election. The ballot would then allow a voter to sign the petition by filling in a box, just like now you fill in a box to vote for a candidate. That is, you would be able to affix your signature to the qualifying petitions on the ballot itself. And, of course, as you have to now, you sign the voter envelope, which every voter has to do now, and those signatures are already verified by the election authorities. This system would eliminate fraud, would it not? It would make the collection of signatures certainly as reliable as the collection of votes in the vote-by-mail system. And second, it would very substantially reduce the cost of verifying signatures, because those signatures on the primary election ballots are already verified. So there are mechanisms to preserve for the citizens of Oregon the use of their initiative process that doesn't require duking it out on the streets, and doesn't require the use of paid signature gatherers at all. If this system were in place, which we call the initiative primary, I would see no reason for anyone to have paid signature collectors to begin with, because it would be perfectly practical to collect signatures on a statewide measure by using this system. And would also make the opportunity to sign initiatives much more widely available. Right now, let's say that you've heard about an initiative and you want to sign the petition. What can you do about it? Where can you find it? Maybe you can go to the Secretary of State's website. Maybe you can find the chief petitioners and call them up, etc. It takes quite a bit of effort to be able to sign a petition unless someone is on the street asking you to do so. Under this system, you would know that you would have an opportunity to sign petitions for initiatives on the primary election ballot. And the full You could even print the full text of the petitions in the voter's pamphlet if you wish to, in addition to the ballot title, or you could make the ballot titles longer than they are now to provide more information to voters. In any event, there are ways, I think, to get us out of this situation we're in now, which I think is only harmful to the initiative process as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Burdick.
Madam Chair, on the Senate Bill 706, I think the proponents of this agreed that there is a necessity to make provisions for people who are disabled. And I know that in my campaign, I certainly did help out people who had difficulty writing to print their name. And we also, as a campaign, would print above somebody's name that was illegible. Neither of those activities, I think, would interfere with the real purpose of this, which is to prevent the wholesale, I mean, you saw the video, the wholesale collection of just simple signatures where it's pretty clear that the person hasn't been given an opportunity to read the petition, to discuss the petition, and to evaluate whether they wanted to sign it. So if this could be fixed to allow initiative campaigns to correct an illegible signature and to allow elderly and disabled, would you look more favorably on Senate Bill 706?
Yes, we would. In addition, however, some people who are not handicapped and not elderly, I think I would count myself in that category for at least a little bit longer, also have illegible printing. In that case, I would think that the exception should apply not only to the elderly and the handicapped, but also to the scriptographically challenged. I have to come up with a...
But if you did get help from someone and help to sign it, and then your petitions were turned in timely, say within the 90 days, and someone who was reviewing those were to look at this situation, to look at this line, and they would call you up, say they would track you down, like the Voter Education Project actually tracked down people who had signed petitions. And they called you and said, you know, what's the deal? Did you really mean to sign this petition? And you said, yes. I mean, there's a protection there. Don't you agree?
Well, I'm troubled by the notion of people who sign petitions then being subjected to phone calls later by opponents of the measure. I really am. Many people.
It is a public record.
A public record.
They're public records when they're turned in, regardless. They're still public records. Someone could go down there today and call people up.
Sure. But the impetus, however, for calling the signer is much reduced if they are turned in, you know, in the first week in July rather than turned in early. If they're turned in early, I can see campaigns gearing up to start calling people who have signed petitions and asking if they really signed it. Some percentage of folks, even those who fully understood the measure when they signed it, won't remember doing so and will say that they, well, maybe not, maybe I didn't sign it. That's inevitable that would occur. And it does trouble me. For example, when I'm collecting signatures, I'm often asked, is this going to be used for something else? Am I going to be getting on mailing lists? Am I going to be getting, telemarketing phone calls? Are you selling things? And very good. Okay. With the 90-day advance turn-in, I think that it would be impossible to say to people, no, you won't be called, because you quite likely may be called.
Yeah. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Meek, very much.
Thank you.
Next, Jason Williams and Ross Day. Will you come forward, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Ross Day, Director of Legal Affairs at Oregonians in Action. I know that the hour grows long, so I will try to keep my comment short. I think the saying is sound and fury, much sound and fury signifying nothing, is how I think the saying goes, and I think that's what we can say about these bills. My recollection was that the bill of sale we were sold in the 2002 election was that the purpose of Measure 26 was to eliminate the fraud, the alleged fraud, forging, whatever you want to call it, in the signature gathering business. That's why we went away from per signature payments to an out, presumably an hourly rate. I can't help but notice that certainly in some of the submitted testimony and some of the oral testimony that you've heard today, that a lot of the proponents of these measures have said, well, the purpose of this is to get rid of the incentive for fraud. Well, I thought that's what Measure 26 was supposed to do. For instance, I'm looking at one of the some of the submitted written testimony that states that additionally this bill will prevent the practice of sandbagging. That is, when a petitioner gather signatures, then hold on to them when the price increases. Well, the price can increase because we're not paying by the signature anymore. We're paying by the hour. Presumably, maybe I suppose maybe they might ask for a higher hourly rate. I'm not sure, but that's not based on the signature themselves. They're still getting paid by the hour. So I'm wondering if maybe we ought to give Measure 26 a chance to take effect and see if it really does what the proponents of the measure said it was going to do. It's March of 2003. We're 5 months out from the election, and we're being told that we need to take additional steps in order to protect the integrity of the initiative system. I was also concerned by the comments, I think, made by Senator Burdick, maybe with Senator Devlin, about these being aimed at protecting, quote, legitimate petitioners, end quote. Now, I don't know who a legitimate petitioner is. I don't know what they look like. I couldn't begin to tell you what a legitimate petitioner is, but I don't know that anybody in this room can tell us who a legitimate petitioner is and who they aren't. The great thing about that pesky constitution of ours is that it gives all citizens the right to use the initiative, not just legitimate petitioners. And so to the extent that these measures are aimed at selecting a qualified few who might be able to enjoy the right of Article 4, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution, I think that the purpose behind them is improper. And finally, on Senate Bill 780, I have a particular concern about that. That's the one that would require signature sheets be submitted 90 days after the first signature on the sheet has been gathered. Before I was working over at OIA, I was in private practice and had the opportunity to represent a lot of chief petitioners and other folks in the initiative process on both sides of the aisle. I represent people on the food labeling law, and also represented people on the Metro Preservation Neighborhood Preservation Act. I think it was late September or early October. I had two disturbing phone calls, and all I can tell you is one person was from Clackamas County, one person was from Benton County. OEA members. I'm an OEA member. I got the same phone call. From somebody saying, hey, did you sign this petition? Do you know what this petition does? How could you sign this petition? They mailed them, they sent them the letter, and so on and so forth. And they called me up, and they said, well, we got your name from so-and-so, and we're told that you might be able to handle this kind of stuff. How is it that they got my name? How is it that they, you know, could call me up and do thus and such? You know, I'm really terrified. I mean, the person from Clackamas County, she told me she was really terrified that the folks from that the folks on the Voter Education Project would call them up and start harassing them about this. And I know I won't forget that. I won't ever forget that. And I had never been more angry in my life about it. I mean, it was so obvious to me what the intent of the phone call was. My concern about Senate Bill 780 is it just facilitates that. Makes it that much easier for groups on either side. I don't mean to pick on the Voter Education Project or anybody else. I mean, for OIA, makes it that much easier for us to get these initiative petitions and call somebody up and say, what are you thinking? Why did you do this? I can't believe you would do something like this. That just really concerns me. The courts have a phrase in this area called the chilling effect. And I certainly think that something that allowing something like this will cause a chilling effect for many people. And to the extent that the committee is seriously considering Senate Bill 780, I would consider those effects as well. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. And I'll be very brief here. I just want to remind everyone that, you know, the initiative process has been around for 102 years. It's been working fantastic. And fraud has been a problem. And I remember people testifying in other committees saying that that they had problems with people with fraud, and they went to the state for help, but nothing was done. They couldn't get any traction on it. But now that there are a lot of people that do not like the initiative process, and suddenly we see efforts to finally crack down on it, which I feel, if you want to crack down on fraud, go after the crime. Some of these bills, I feel like, are opening up new gray areas to knock out signatures, knock out initiatives from making the ballot. And, you know, for instance, with the filling in of the name, I mean, if someone writes in their name and address but leaves out the word OR for Oregon, is that going to be something so they can strike out the whole signature? And if they strike out the whole signature, does that mean that counts as 20 signatures that doesn't count? So I see it as creating gray areas to only do one thing. That's negative for the initiative process. Senate Bill 565, with this, you have to say how this will affect three different parts of government. Well, that's only giving the government side. If you're going to do that, saying this bill will affect education and police or whatever, well, then say this bill will affect the public spending on your retirement, your children's education, or, you know, your children's tuition or whatever. Give the taxpayer side. So that's why, you know, Senate Bill 565 is just, it only meets the needs of government and doesn't give a fair balance to it. The idea about Senate Bill 680 about going after the people that are accused of fraud, we should go after the criminal, not the innocent people. If there are people that signed up for the initiative, they shouldn't be penalized or punished for the person who committed the fraud. I'd like to see that person committing the fraud see jail time, but it should have nothing to do with the innocent people that are involved in the measure or who have been deceived. In terms of Senate Bill 780 with the 90 days, boy, you know, I don't like adding on things to government, and you know, I'm hesitant to do that. Sometimes it's okay, but the idea of some of these measures, you know, sometimes there's 80,000 signature sheets. I mean, 80,000 signatures that get all the way up there, and they don't make it. They're short by 5 or 10,000. Do you really want the Secretary of State to go through all these initiatives that are close but never make it? I would rather have them not send it through the process and just put their signature sheets away. So it just makes no sense in that regard to put the Secretary of State through that process. So those are just some of the areas. I think we ought to be looking for things that strengthen the process, not open it up for, you know, all kinds of lawsuits that only have one thing, and that is to imbalance it and to make it easier to knock out signatures or knock out things out of the ballot, especially when it affects innocent people that are caught up in it. So that is our concern.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you staying. John Lindbeck, Secretary of State's office, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindbeck, Director of the Elections Division in the Secretary of State's office. I'll try to keep this brief because I know the hour is late. I'm here to testify in strong support of Senate Bill 706. As most of you may recall, I gave a presentation to a joint meeting of the Rules Committees on problems in the initiative process and talked to you about the problems created by these so-called writers. And we have a bill on the House side that was introduced by the Secretary of State, House Bill 2143, that includes a similar ban on writers and says that the person filling out the petition is the person who should fill out all the information that they about themselves. And there's two reasons for that, and I think reason number one is the fraud problem exemplified by the Frankel Gerg case. Reason number two, as you may recall, I talked to you about in my presentation that the writers misspell the names sometimes. and that has resulted in an initial invalidation of signatures that were really valid. And that's not doing the chief petitioners any favors. And so we think the time really has come to do something about riders. What I'm passing around to you is an example of one petition, one county, petition 18 from the last cycle, Clackamas County petitions. And if you take a look at the total number of petitions turned in from Clackamas County, 20% of them were filled in by riders. And we think that's typical. That 20% or more of the petitions handled in the initiative process today are dealt with by riders. That's a lot. And it potentially has created some serious problems, and it's really time to do something about this problem. I want to address a mischaracterization by one of the prior witnesses who indicated that this bill would, if you left Oregon off on the address, would that invalidate the signature? It would not. What this bill does and what the Secretary of State's bill does on the House side is it simply says that whatever information is filled out by the signer has to be filled out by the signer themselves. It does not say that they have to fill out everything on the petition. In fact, under state law, the only thing that you are required to sign as a signer, to put on the petition as a signer, is your signature. But, of course, you're encouraged to do more than that because to the extent that your signature may be illegible, that extra information is helpful to the counties in trying to verify that signature. So I just wanted to straighten out that misconception. I'll need those original copies back, or I have to put Mr. Stembridge in elections jail because those are original copies that we have to keep in the vault in the Secretary of State's office.
If Stembridge goes to jail, if you don't get too bad.
Well, yeah, yeah. I'd rather say I'm putting him in jail than one of you, frankly.
But we could go to jail as well, is what you're not saying. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for not being here for the last few minutes. Would you see a problem in the case that was given by Mr. Meek where somebody had an illegible, now I'm doing it, signature, and the petition gatherer printed it above that person's name? Would you see a problem with that?
I do not see a problem. In fact, we're going to suggest an amendment in our bill on the House side that deals with folks that have a disability it makes it a problem for them to sign, or people that flat out have...
Right, and I assume you wouldn't have a problem with the person with a disability.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, Madam Chairman, my observation was that even people who had difficulty filling out the petition were pretty strongly motivated to do it. So I think in mm-hmm. a lot of those cases, the ability to print above it is perhaps more valuable than actually filling it in. People, especially in my observation, some of the elderly people just took the responsibility of signing a petition very seriously, and they may have taken more time, but if they were able to, they really wanted to see it through as a project.
I really see this provision, Senator Burdick, as a protection for both the signer of the petition mm-hmm. and for the chief petitioners, because the signers, if they print their name themselves, they'll probably spell it right. And that will help the chief petitioner get more valid signatures.
Right. And I must say that in my time as a chief petitioner, I never had a single complaint from someone who complained about the time it took to sign their address. I never had people ask me to do it. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, John. And we will give your petitions back. That's all the sign-ups we have. So we are adjourned.
Thank you.